At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Thank you so much for giving us the most precious thing you have, your time, as we continue to do what we always try to do. We're going to turn down the noise of the news cycle, get to some information that we actually need to better discern the times we live in. And there's been a lot of stuff you might have heard tell about going on in space. We finally got the Boeing Starliner up in space. NASA did that. Starship, SpaceX's heavy lift object, they got it up. And more importantly, they got it back down without it blowing up. A lot of stuff going on in space. We are very blessed to have Dr. Michael Siegel, who's on this program regularly. He's been a good friend. He's a writer at Ordinary Times. His side hustle, though, is he actually flies a spaceship. This is what he does as an astronomer and astrophysicist. He knows a lot about this stuff, and we're going to talk to him about what's going on, because there's a lot going on with this space stuff. It's very different from, look, everything we do in space is going to get compared to the space race, putting men on the moon, that sort of thing. And there's this thing where we're trying to get back to the moon and maybe to Mars. That captures part of the imagination, but there's a lot more going on than just that. How do we proceed in space? We now have this kind of all of the above thing going on, where we have private ventures and the public venture, NASA, doing all this. But we're not the only country doing it. India has a space program. China has a space program. Russia's got a big mess on their hands, but they still nominally have a space program. So there's things like the International Space Station. It's getting really old. They're going to have some hard decisions coming up on what they're going to do with that. There's a lot going on besides just when are we going to the moon, when are we going to put people on Mars, and all the sci-fi stuff. Plus, this stuff, people think, well, it's a space program. What does that have to do with anything? Public versus private funding to achieve things. We see that in tech. We see that in healthcare. We're debating that in our schools. Everything is a debate about public versus private, really. This is just a different branch of that same argument. So there's public policy things here. There's monetary considerations, public funding, private funding. Which one's better? We talked to Dr. Michael Siegel about it. SpaceX kind of has a, well, let's launch it, blow it up, learn from it, do it again. NASA can't do that because it's publicly funded, because it has oversight. But there's good and bad to both ways of doing it. We're going to talk about that with Michael today. Also, we delve a little bit into some things that I find really interesting, like going back and revisiting the space program. This Starliner capsule on the outside looks very similar to the Apollo mission capsule. Now, interiorly, it's completely different composite-wise, electronic-wise, all that. We talk about things like the ICC, the International Space Station we just talked about. It just can't produce enough power for a modern space station. It's been up there a long time. It was designed back in the 80s and early 90s. It's just old. What do we do with that thing? There's practical things that we got to discuss when it comes to space, and we talk about that, like rockets. The rocket that took up the Starliner was a variation on the Atlas rocket that we put the Mercury astronauts up in orbit on. That's 65, 70 years of technology. Has rockets kind of peaked out? Are we plateaued on that technology? Because the rockets we're using, we're having the debates on them that they had back in the 30s when they first started doing rocket technology to start with. We talk about all this with Michael Siegel. It's a great conversation, taking the headlines we're seeing about space, SpaceX, NASA, Starliner, spacecraft, all this fun stuff, right? Starship, the heavy lift. What does heavy lift actually mean? Breaking it all down, taking the headlines, talking through it in a way that even I understood it. I got a couple things wrong. Michael corrects me. So if you like me being wrong, you're going to like this episode. All that today on This Herd Tell, right after this.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. Okay, we haven't talked space in a while with our buddy, Dr. Michael Siegel. It's long overdue, and there's a lot of news on space and science and exploration the last couple of days, especially the last 2 or 3 weeks. We want to get into all that because, let's face it, we need a break from politics. So let's look to the stars, buddy. How are you, sir?
I'm not bad. How are you doing?
Oh, we're hanging in there. All right, you already corrected me. That is the Crab Nebula behind you, for those of you watching on the YouTube channel. I thought it was the Tarantula Nebula. My bad, wrong bug. Nice nebula,
though. Yeah, it's the JWST image that they published about a week ago. And so this bright dot in the center, that's the pulsar powering the nebula. Then you've got the ring, that's a shock wave. And then you've got the expanded nebula being illuminated by the pulsar inside.
Now, those of us that just watch, you know, Star Trek and stuff, would you really want to take a spaceship and hide it like a submarine inside of a nebula? Because that's kind of the trope in things like Star Trek and everything. It's like, oh, we're being attacked. Let's just duck into this nebula right quick. Is that like a plane flying into a cloud? Because I remember when I was doing my aviation stuff, like some clouds you fly into, they're pretty pleasant. Some clouds you fly into, they will kill you. Is that kind of how a nebula would work if we actually tried to put a spaceship in one of them?
Yeah, sort of. It's they tend to be a lot more dispersed and low density than what you see in the movies. Even though they are way denser than the rest of the universe, you're still talking about a density that you wouldn't be able to feel it. If you're in the outer regions, they aren't as unstable as what they show in the movies. For a particularly young nebula, like a recent supernova or something like that, it could be very interesting to go inside. But we actually don't know a lot about the dynamics of young nebulae. That's one of the things that HST is trying to reveal to us.
All right. Well, let's get to the headlining stuff. Starliner finally got up in space with two people and mostly did what it did. There were some malfunctions. We'll talk about those in a minute. Within days, spacecraft down at the SpaceX folks, they got their heavy lift up again. There's just no way these two things are not going to get compared. You have, you know, the Boeing Starliner and NASA. That thing's been over a decade now. They've gotten two people up in space one time. SpaceX has gotten up something like 13 times in the same period, roughly. Is it a fair comparison? Because there's just no way they're not going to get compared. Is it a fair comparison, though?
I think it's a reasonably fair comparison that Boeing is way behind on their plans for the Starliner. This was only their third launch and their first crewed launch, and they did have some malfunctions, but they were comparatively minor, nothing that really endangered the crew or anything like that. So it was a success, but compared to what SpaceX has been doing for the last 10 years, I mean, they have their Dragon capsules been going for a long time. It's a little smaller than Starliner, but it's still been going up quite a bit. And of course, they build their own rockets. This one went up on another rocket. So I think Boeing's a bit playing catch up, like a lot of the traditional aerospace industry, that SpaceX is kind of, they're the maverick, that they, you know, their philosophy is, you know, blow up stuff and break things, literally blow up stuff, and, you know, pioneer that way. Whereas Boeing has a more staid approach because they're a traditional aerospace company. But in the end, we now have two capsules that can get to the space station And that's good to have, you know, options and so forth. Someone pointed out that, you know, these were two NASA astronauts that flew this one. This was only the sixth time that that NASA astronauts flew the maiden voyage of a new spaceship. So it's still a remarkable achievement. And hopefully Boeing will move on from this. I mean, they have their own problems with their airplanes too. So they've got a lot on their plate right now. But hopefully this will not only mean Boeing continues to make progress, but the other traditional aerospace companies get into the industry.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. Okay, here's the thing about it that kind of stuck out too to me, though, was that I heard that stat too, the only the sixth time they've ever done it. They put this thing up with an Atlas rocket. And the other historical thing was this was the first time since the Mercury program we're putting people up with an Atlas class rocket. Obviously, it's not the same rocket. We're not shooting off 70-year-old rockets here. But the nuts and bolts of the thing's pretty much the same. Obviously, there's digital technology and stuff added to it. Is that a good thing or a bad thing that a lot of this rocket technology, we're still doing it, but have we plateaued and now we're starting to rise up again? Do we just know about everything there is to know about rockets at this point? Because you see blow up and break stuff with SpaceX. They're blowing it up and breaking it to figure out how to put it together. Where are we at with the actual rocket technology? Because it's pretty amazing that are we doing incremental growth, or are we having leap and bounds, or where are we at with this? Because that stat blew me away.
I think that there was a really good article, unfortunately, I think it's behind the paywall, by Greg Easterbrook a few months ago about big, dumb rockets and how NASA sort of went down this hole with making rockets that were ultra-reliable and used the most sophisticated technology or very efficient, but wound up being extraordinarily expensive. You know, they use solid rocket fuel and so forth, whereas, you know, SpaceX is the Starship that they just launched was, you know, a pretty traditional rocket using fossil fuels, you know, kerosene rockets and so forth. And there is a very good case that those rockets, while not as sophisticated as the solid rocket boosters and so forth that NASA is using, are much cheaper, much more reliable, much more mechanically simple, and therefore they can get the cost way down. To give you a comparison, the Space Launch System that NASA is using for the Artemis mission, costing $2 billion a launch. Starship, from SpaceX is projected to cost $100 million per launch. You know, Elon really thinks that with this sort of traditional rocket technology, we can get the cost of putting things in space down to maybe $100 a pound, which is 1% of what it once was. You know, you think about that means a trip to space, to orbit, for a typical person would cost them less than a car. And, you know, I know I actually had a poll on this on my Twitter account. Most people said they wouldn't pay that much. I would pay that much to get into space. I don't know if my family would let me, but it would also be a very good incentive to lose weight if they're charging you by the pound. But there's a little bit of a subtlety here in that, yes, much of this technology is tried and true, you know, kerosene rockets and the sort of typical fuel we've been using in construction. But on the other hand, the guidance systems, the control systems, those are extraordinarily sophisticated. You know, we couldn't land Apollo rockets on their tails like SpaceX does. We couldn't return Atlas rockets for reuse. And so, you know, with Starship's launch the other day, they had a burn through on one of the fins, but they were still able to control the rocket. There was a famous video from the, I'm trying to remember the name. I want to say Ariana, but that's not it. One of the new startups in rocketry, where their rocket took off and just sort of hovered over the launch pad and went sideways a little bit, and then eventually took off because they had an engine failure on launch. And someone pointed out that's extraordinarily good guidance if you can have a malfunction like that and not have the rocket explode on the launch pad. So yes, this is technology that is tried and true that we've been using for decades. But on the other hand, it's being used in a way that is very modern, very sophisticated, that tries to improve on these things in different ways than, you know, completely overhauling the way that we do rocketry.
T
driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. This goes back to the very beginning, this cheap versus, you know, technical reuse versus one-time use. This goes back to the 30s. Wernher von Braun, who, of course, we stole from the Nazis and made the head of NASA, and that's kind of where we got our whole space program. Him and his whole debate, they had this debate way back in the 30s. Are we going to use, you know, direct fuel and combustion? Are we going to use a chemical reaction from the hot vapors? This goes back to the very early days of rocketry, this argument of cheap versus more complex, reuse versus not reuse. None of this is really new arguments, right? This is kind of just how scientific theory and rockets and space travel has been from the very go.
I think that it's gotten more to the point of being a real debate over real technology rather than discussing theoreticals of how to guide what at that time were non-existent rocket programs. But I think the number of people getting into this field and the sophistication and the what we've learned over the last century of rocketry has really gotten us to the point where we have lots of options. We have lots of paths to explore. I don't think there's any one solution to getting into space. I think it's going to depend on what your goals are, you know, obviously what orbit you're getting into, what cargo you're lifting. And so having different options from different companies, having different paths to get into space rather than just funneling everything through the NASA corridor is creating what is essentially now a golden age of space exploration.
Yeah, it really is. There's an old thing in engineering where reliable plus simpler equals safer. That's kind of always been the formula in engineering, and NASA used to adapt that in a lot of ways. Bureaucracy is antithetical to that. So while we're watching SpaceX with, you know, as you put it, blow stuff up and see what happens and learn to the next one, that seems counterproductive to reliable plus simpler equals safer. But in reality, that's actually closer to the mark than what the bureaucracy of NASA is. Is that what we're seeing kind of play out here in a lot of ways? And not that NASA's not being safe. That's not what I'm getting at. But is there a thing of just we make it so complicated to get to the safer part, we forget about the reliability part?
I think that the NASA rocket, the things that NASA does are very reliable. And that's been the kind of the criticism that they don't want things to blow up, that it looks very bad for them. And so
for good reason. I mean, we've had Apollo 1, we had Apollo 13, nobody died. But what we didn't know, we'll probably never know how many people the Russians actually lost in their space program, both in the air and on the ground. It had to be a lot of people because they buried a lot of it. There's good reason for that. It's not an unfair criticism.
Not even that. It's even in the testing phase, they prefer to test with simulations and on the ground and so forth, whereas SpaceX is more, let's launch it and see what happens. And I don't think you can be very that risk averse to when you're testing phase. But as someone pointed out, you know, SpaceX rockets, their main rocket it failed the first three times it launched, and then now it's had 200 launches without a failure. And so there is value to being willing to watch a test rocket blow up and getting it to the point where it's reliable before you start putting important cargo, including people, on it. NASA takes a different approach, and I understand why they take that approach, and they have different priorities. But it's, again, good to have different pathways to this, because, you know, what NASA is doing is also feeding development within the industry.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. Both of these missions had some minor failures, but they overcame them to be successful missions. I know that terminology, the engineers and the space people nitpick it. Excuse me. The space people will nitpick that a little bit, but there was failures inside of these successes. The Starliner had a hydrogen leak and a thruster issue, but it still got to the space station. That's a big deal, because 5 years ago on one of their tests, they actually couldn't get to the space station because the flight data turned out to be bad. That sounds kind of ungood. Kind of need the flight data to be accurate, right? And yeah. Even on the Starship launch, there was the now famous video that went viral of the flap, or the guidance flap, whatever that was, literally coming apart, but they were still able to get it to a soft splashdown, which is simulating a landing later on the ship, even though it was in the water. They had video all the way to the water. It was really spectacular to watch.
Yep.
You're on a mission. You have a spacecraft. I know late last year, you actually worried about losing the spacecraft. When you're troubleshooting something in real time, something that's in space, take us behind the scenes of troubleshooting something that in reality, you don't have a whole lot of options probably other than, well, we hope we built this thing well. Let's see if we can get it to keep working. Take us behind the scenes of troubleshooting something like that, because we've seen Apollo 13, right? That's a little glorified. It's a lot of engineering speak. It's a lot of code. It's a lot of data. But take us behind the scenes on trying to fix something that's flying in space.
Well, there's several chapters to my response here. The Starliner, what it had was a helium leak. Helium is used to pressurize the fuel lines.
My bad. And I said nitrogen. Sorry.
That's all right. Easy to mix those up. But it's an inert element, but it uses it to pressurize the fuel lines. And so that meant that the thrusters were not good. And then they had a thruster failure when they got there. But they had enough thrusters that it was, even if they had not reset them and got them to come back, for the five to come back, they still would have been able to dock. So it's a relatively minor failure, but considering that they have had this multiple times now, something that they want to look at very carefully. With Apollo 13, that was an amazing thing where you were, if that were not a manned mission, you would have let it go because it was not worth the effort to save it. But because there were people on board and wanted to get them back safely, we invested a tremendous amount of effort in it. And the movie, if you've watched Apollo 13, if anything, that understates what was going on. I was reading through the transcript while I was preparing my video on Apollo 13, and it was just constant stuff that they were having to do. It was nonstop. But but in terms of spacecraft, I work with the Swift mission. We have had anomalies in the past, and the anomaly we had last year was a gyroscope failure. Every spacecraft uses gyroscopes, these spinning top things, to get itself oriented in space so it knows where it's pointing. Most have redundant gyroscopes. HST has six of them. We have three, so that if you know, you make sure they agree with each other. And also, if you know, you get failures, you have backups. HST now is actually down to one gyroscope after a recent failure. We had a gyroscope kind of go wonky, and then it took a while, but we actually got that to go onto the two other gyroscopes. And we're actually pointing better than we ever have in the life of the mission. But in terms of behind the scenes, you're very careful. It took us probably about 8 months to eventually put the fix in that we did, because first you try small things. You know, can we make this software adjustment? Can we make, I can't get into the details because it's export controlled, but can we make this software adjustment? Will that improve it? Can we make this adjustment? Will that improve it? Anytime you want to make a spacecraft change, you have hardware on the ground that mimics what you have in space. You can test it on the ground to make sure it's not going to break anything. You call in the engineers who like know this stuff, you know, better than anyone on the planet to make sure you're doing this right. You have all kinds of experts in here because fixing something in space is not only complicated, But if it breaks, it's in space. You can't go up there and whack it on the side of the head or hit the restart button or anything like that. So you go about these things very, very carefully because you know you're in a stable state. You don't want to get into an unstable state. So you make little changes, maybe make them for a little time, unmake the change, see what has happened since you've made that change, and so forth. With what went on with Starliner this weekend, this was pretty straightforward. They closed the manifolds on the helium flow with the rockets, with the thrusters that were malfunctioning. They restarted them and then reignited them, and they worked. And so this was pretty straightforward. But with all these things, with anything in space, you take it one step at a time, going through every phase, every step. You know, if it's doing this thing wrong at step 49, you want to go through steps 1 to 48 to see if changes there can fix it and if changes there are not going to break it.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. All right, realistically, what are we looking at here? Because we seem to be right now in this thing where we're sending people up and down to the space station. Space station's getting old. They're going to have to make a decision on that thing before too awful long. But we can set that aside for another time. So we're going to the space station. You have Elon Musk talking about colonizing Mars within the next 5 years. That's not going to happen. We can just go ahead and say that's not going to happen. However, let's go pie in the sky for just a second. Going back to the moon, eventually going to Mars. Do we need to recalibrate how we envision that in our mind? Because we've watched way too much sci-fi now. I know one of the real eminent experts on this stuff the other day was talking about, you know, Musk saying go to Mars. He's like, well, Musk doesn't understand what you got to do to go to Mars. You've got to build a factory. It's not a colony where people just hang out. You got to build a factory that can make food, can make air, can make all these things. That seems like a real important paradigm shift in our thinking of what it would actually be like to go to the moon and actually be there, not just land and leave after a day or two, or later on going to Mars, which is an even more austere environment in a lot of ways. Is that factory mindset of what you'd have to build to be on an outer body in the space, like a moon, like Mars, would that be more helpful from your point of view, from an, you know, an engineering point of view, a space traveling point of view? No, we need to build a factory up there so you can sustain life. You're not just going to show up with a tent and hang out.
Yes, that is absolutely true. You have, if you were putting people on Mars, you not only have the need for air and food, you need shelter from radiation. The Earth's atmosphere and magnetic field shield us from cosmic radiation. That would not be the case when you're on Mars. Even if when astronauts went to the moon, they would see flashes of light in their eyes from cosmic rays going through their eyes. I mean, it wasn't a dangerous amount of radiation. But if you're out there for weeks or months, now you're talking about it. Probably with Mars and the moon, you're talking about building most of the structure underground, where you can use the ground to shield you from radiation. But to me, people who talk about it in terms of sustainability, that we're going to send robots there, we're going to plant materials there, we're going to build the HAB before the astronauts land, that's a more serious take on this. To go to popular culture, if you have read the book or seen the movie The Martian, that is actually a very realistic approach to Mars. And Andy Weir, like, kind of not only did research, but crowdsourced some of it to get realistic ideas, where you put most of the material on the Mars in advance. You have the rocket in advance that's going to return them to orbit. You have a shuttle that goes between Earth orbit and Mars orbit that does that transfer, and then a transfer from the surface to that spaceship. And so these are massive undertakings that you're talking about costing hundreds of billions of dollars. And so Elon says 5 years, that's not going to happen. But I do think that we are in a point where a realistic return to the moon is tenable, where creating a colony on the moon, especially if we found that the moon has resources like helium-3 that might be useful on Earth, that is tenable within the next few decades. I think the big thing that we'll see coming up in the next few decades is more space stations, more private space stations, more government stations. China just put up a space station. I think we're going to see more of that to do research in environments above the atmosphere, you know, for space tourism, for that sort of thing. I think that that's the real thing to watch for in the next few decades, is to see where we go with space, with more space stations.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. That was the next thing I was going to ask anyways, the space station stuff, because look, the ICC is getting old. By anybody's stretch of the imagination, they're having, it's not terminal stuff, but they're constantly having problems with it now, just because of the age. Until now, you know, we had a stretch there where we could only get up there with the Russians. That wasn't really, you know, ideal, because they've got their own issues in their space program, not to mention the dictator regime you got to go through to use them. There's just issues with the ICC. So is the answer to not have to funnel everything through one ICC, just have a couple of them, or to have, because there's also the debate, and you just brought it up, China's got their own space station. Well, we're going to wind up in a situation like we did with the Soviets, where for the most part, even when it was the Soviet Russia and now the Russian Federation, most of the space stuff's been decently smooth. There hadn't been a whole lot of politics and stuff, but as we saw with like things like Ukraine, that can change really fast. China's a whole different beast where they have complete control and they're even more closed off in a lot of ways. Are we going to have a sectarian issue in space? Is that what we're looking at going forward? Because we need more space stations, but then it might get rid of a lot of the cooperation we've enjoyed for the last 40 years or so.
Yeah, it's very hard to predict where things are going to go that way politically. The ISS is very old. It's, the first stages were put up in the 90s, and it's very 80s design. And, you know, to support the astronaut crew on the ISS requires a work of hundreds of people on the ground to monitor everything that's going on and so forth. I think that's one of the next big things that need to be researched. I haven't heard anything about this, but one of the best things that needs to be researched in the next few years is how to get a space station that requires a lot less on-ground support for the astronauts to survive. And so I would really, and rather than, you know, throwing things into a pie-in-the-sky idea of Mars, I would much rather prefer Elon throwing things into, how can we build more sustainable space stations? How can we build cheaper space stations? How can we make these so that they are more accessible to our country, to industry, to other countries, and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and the other thing with the space station stuff I'm curious about is, you mentioned part of it. I was reading some technical stuff. Like I nerded out so I don't look like a total idiot when I talk to you, because you're so much smarter than I am on this stuff.
I nerded out too, so I don't look like an idiot.
But one thing that was explained to me, and this is in the comparison, we always talk about, you know, the Navy and space is kind of, you know, it comes from sci-fi a little bit, but there's parallels there. One of the problems the Navy's had with their older ships, and one of the reasons they retired a lot of the 70s and 80s ships, even before their lifespan, is they can't get enough power to them, just electrical power, because new things like computers and Wi-Fi and all this, it takes a massive amount of electrical power. And that's one of the problems they're having with the ICC right now, is you just can't get enough power to do everything you need to do on it, because it was designed in the 70s and 80s. They didn't know they were going to need this much electricity for that sort of stuff. That sounds like a real minor thing. But if you think about a wired house in the 70s having to carry all the modern appliances, it's not a perfect comparison, but that's exactly the kind of problems they're facing. Like, they just don't have enough electrical outlets in the bathroom like you would in an old house. Like, well, I need this outlet by my mirror in the bathroom. That's the kind of practical stuff they're dealing with an older spacecraft design like the International Space Station.
Yeah. I think the electrical problems are solvable using existing technology. But yeah, and that's again why you need to be thinking more into the future of what we're doing for the next generation space stations. I think I'm hoping they will keep the ISS going as long as they can. Their last I checked, the plans were to maybe deorbit it in the next 5 to 10 years because they're losing some of the support. But I would prefer to keep the space station going rather than have no presence. But I also think we need to be looking forward to, all right, what do we replace this with? You know, what is the next generation that's going to be more efficient, more self-sustaining, require less ground support? And I don't hear a lot of that in the popular press but that's, I think, the big frontier right now, that we have to establish low Earth orbit before we move on to the moon and Mars.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. Here's another one of those real old things in space thing. The boring stuff doesn't get the headlines, which means it doesn't get the funding, but the boring stuff is what everything's based off of, right? Lower Earth orbit is not as exciting as Elon Musk blowing stuff up and demanding that we go to Mars tomorrow. That's what gets attention. That's what gets money. And he's self-funding a lot of it with our tax dollar, but we'll get into that some other time. But that's the stuff that gets the headlines. Low Earth orbit isn't exciting, but that's where all the technology that we use day to day is all in low Earth orbit, you know, satellite, GPS, that sort of stuff. How do you do that? Because let's all be adults here. NASA's got funding problems. NASA's got a lot of critics in Congress right now. NASA is not a hot button issue for a lot of people because the shine's off them with the SpaceX stuff. Funding for NASA is always going to be a fight. They've got a fight on their hands for this stuff, and that's part of the fight, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the GPS is at high orbit.
I'm sorry, you're smarter than me. I know. I'm just saying it's up there somewhere. It's higher than me.
I just teach this stuff. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known either. And a lot of the communication satellites are very high orbit. But low Earth orbit, that's where you have most of the astrophysics space telescopes. That's where you have the space stations. That's where you have the Elon Musk Starlink and a lot of other communication satellites. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in low Earth orbit that's very important. NASA's funding, and it's being squeezed. They're getting a budget cut this year, an effective budget cut, and astrophysics is being kind of squeezed. They're planning right now, under the current funding profile, they're planning to shut down the Chandra Space Telescope, which is the premier X-ray telescope in the world. And I can't imagine why they would shut that down, because it actually doesn't cost that much compared to everything else. So, yeah, I mean, you want to always sustain the non-sexy stuff, the old telescopes that are still doing yeoman's work, like SWIFT, the one I work for. You want to sustain the space station. You want to sustain, you know, the sort of basic stuff day in, day out that NASA does that are largely invisible to the public, but which sustain a lot of it. An example of something that's kind of invisible would be the TDRS system. I forget what TDRS stands for. Tracking and Data Relay Satellite System, which is a system of satellites we use to communicate with other space missions, to communicate with satellites. We use it to get real-time telemetry from our spacecraft and to get real-time data when we have a gamma ray burst. That's really important, and probably most people have never heard of it. But it's one of those things that NASA sustains that is extremely effective, that is the backbone of a lot of our space program.
Yeah, I feel better that one of the smartest people on the planet still has to Google stuff just like I do. Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. All right, that's enough of the bad stuff. Let's get to the cool stuff. What are we watching for in rocket and space travel? We got the crew. We got the Starliner up with the crew. We've got, you know, Starship down with the SpaceX. Give me a little bit, because I know people talk about the size and we hear about super heavy lift and heavy lift. Give me a little bit of size for what this Starship that SpaceX is playing with. What it really means size-wise, because you're talking about space stations, you got to get components up there. I don't think people realize, I seen it up close when I was on top of the 747 because it landed at Little Rock one time because there was a hurricane. I don't think people realize how big the space shuttle was, because you always see it at a distance. Like, that thing was freaking huge. You got to have big stuff to get big components up into space, whether it's a space station, whether you want to go to Mars, intermediate boosters, whatever you're talking about, lower Earth orbit, higher Earth orbit. Give us a sense of size for this Starship and things like the Falcon Heavy. How big of stuff are we talking about, especially compared to something like the Saturn V, which everybody knows is the moon rockets, because we've all seen that video.
The rocket the Starship that the heavy lift, super heavy lifter that SpaceX is working on is kind of comparable to Saturn in terms of size and lifting power. It's mainly designed, you could use it for one of two things. You could use it to lift heavy cargo into space, or you could use it to launch things into deep space. just because of the enormous amount of lift that that thing is generating.
So is that different? Not to interrupt you, but is that because everybody just assumes, well, you get it up there, you get it up there. But those are two very, very different things.
They are very, very different things. There are space telescopes, for example, that are in low Earth orbit to save money because it costs a lot more money to send things into higher Earth orbit or to Lagrange or something like that, that so forth. You may remember JWST is orbiting around the Lagrange point, this balance point where the sun and Earth's gravity balance. And that took an Ariana 5 rocket, I think, a heavy lifter just to get it up there. Whereas if you were putting that into low Earth orbit, which JWST is, you could use something that's significantly smaller. So it's a matter of how much lifting power you have versus weight and how far you're going to put it. So I don't want to say it's a simple equation because it's extraordinarily complex, but the basics of it are pretty straightforward.
Is it amazing, you know, I'm a simpleton, so, you know, Philistine here on this, but it is amazing that for all the tech, all the SpaceX tech, we talk about, you know, NASA and Starliner, you know, Starliner looks like an Apollo cube. I know it's upsized and all the inside guts of it are all different, but just visually, it looks like an Apollo capsule. This thrust weight ratio is pretty universal, whether it's, you know, trying to push a box across the floor of your house or you're trying to put a rocket into space. It's still kind of the same basic principles. Isn't it amazing? I mean, you're a scientist. You've taught entry-level astronomy and stuff too, so you teach the newbies too. Does it just amaze you how much the simple stuff still applies no matter how far out into space you get? It's still kind of the simple concepts that win the day here?
Until we invent warp drives or something like that, rockets are rockets. You need a certain amount of fuel to get to a certain orbit, to get a certain velocity, and that's how it works. We have made a lot of improvements in the efficiency and the fuels what we use. So, the rockets, I mean, compared to Saturn, Starship is much more sophisticated and although mechanically simpler. But in the end, rockets are rockets. There's a way we are solving this problem and have. And until like we invent science fiction technology like warp drives and anti-gravity or something like that, that's the way it's going to be. And there are alternatives. You could use, for example, magnetic catapults or something like that. But that's not technology that we are terribly interested in investing in at this point.
Dr. Michael Siegel joining us. I've got to bring it up because we're talking about it, but just how, when we talk about revolutionary steps that the human race has done, technology, I mean, you've got the wheel, written language, you know, the real big stuff that really changed things, you know. Where's the Saturn V rocket on that? Because that's got to be like way, even the space capsule, the Saturn V rocket just has to be way, way up on that list somewhere, right?
I don't know in terms of revolutionary technology. There's a lot of technology that has flowed from the Apollo mission. A lot of, for example, medical monitoring and so forth. I mean, we both had our experiences with the medical system. A lot of that technology flowed from Apollo.
Live telemetry all came from the space program. That's absolutely correct.
A lot of the micro miniaturization, a lot of the breakthroughs in computers came from Apollo. So
microwave. You know,
it's not something like the wheel where it's one invention. It was more of a series of innovations that spurred a wave of technological progress throughout our society. But in terms of how I would think of Apollo is not so much as the wheel as being more like the pyramids or the Colossus. It was a wonder of the world, you know, an achievement of a civilization that will be remembered for centuries, that, you know, this country, you know, with a pretty young technology was able to put a man on the moon just because we decided to do it. And that's, you know, apart from the technological breakthroughs, that's pretty remarkable.
Have we lost that? Because I think we have, because now it's all commercial. We're going to go to Mars, but it's to save the human race or it's to get money or whatever. I hate to do pie in the sky, but look, this is space travel. It's pie in the sky. It's sci-fi. It's living. Like, it's just really freaking cool to blast stuff off on a rocket. It's cool to travel in space. I have berated you for years. Like, why didn't you open with, I fly a spacecraft? That should be the first thing you say to people when you meet them at Outback, right? This stuff's just cool, but we've also you know, it's almost like the Apollo 13 opening is like, well, nobody's watching because we're all bored with it now. There's exciting stuff happen, but are we taking it for granted some?
I think that was inevitable. You know, when Charles Lindbergh first crossed the Atlantic, it was a world-shaking event. You know, I've crossed the Atlantic a dozen times and nobody had a parade for me because, you know, it's what he did was he showed it was possible and now it's routine. And I think we've gotten to the point with space travel where a lot of it's routine. We have, not a lot of people realize this, we have more rocket launches in the last few years than we had in the previous couple of decades. We're having rocket launches on a regular basis. You know, it doesn't get a lot of press that we're in a golden age of space launches, but we are. And I didn't know until I looked it up that SpaceX had a, you know, something like 200 successful launches. And, you know, that's just, you know, what is a miracle? Today's miracle becomes tomorrow's routine. And that's just the way it goes. And I'm hoping we can get some excitement back with, you know, returning to the moon and so forth. But again, that's where, you know, before it was a wonder of the world achievement. Now we're starting to think, okay, what can we do on the moon? How can this sustain future missions? How, what can it benefit people on Earth? You know, what's the practical side of it? And I think that's just inevitable that, you know, what once was world-shaking news becomes routine.
So post-World War II, taking, you know, 40 years of the automobile and deciding to make the Mustang and the Camaro and all that, and all of a sudden things change a little bit. Would that be a good, you know, I know it's not a perfect analogy, but is that kind of more like we're kind of at a midpoint here? We're like, okay, we've figured out how to make this practical. Now we're going to start seeing some sexy stuff because we're going to start doing something really amazing with it. Maybe that's a better way to look at it.
Maybe. I'd have to think about that.
But I know you're not a car guy, you're a space guy, but still, Dr. Michael Siegel. All right, give us a couple things to pay attention to looking forward. I know the SpaceX Boeing thing, that story, we're both writers. That story writes itself. You got to have competition, right? Yes. We'll have that stuff, but practically, what are we looking for coming up in space stuff over the next couple? I know the NASA budget fight, something to kind of keep an eye on, especially as Congress probably is going to change over after the election. What should we be looking for space-wise in the near future, you think?
There are several things to look for this year. One is, although it's not related to space exploration, is Aurora. We had a very powerful Aurora earlier this month that was visible all the way down in Texas, I believe. I didn't see it because it was clouded out because, of course, that's central Pennsylvania for you. But if you pay attention to space weather, and if you hear about another Aurora, the sun is very active right now. I have a video on my channel explaining how Aurora work. So that's something to keep an eye on that you might get on short notice. Hey, the sun just had a huge storm. We might get Aurora. And people who saw it said it was magical. The other thing to look forward to is Artemis. Hopefully we'll have their launch that will, I think that's later this year. I can't remember how long they delayed it for, to put astronauts around the moon in the next Artemis launch. And especially the thing to look forward to is more results from JWST. They're looking a lot at these exoplanets. And what they're looking for right now are what we call biosignatures, signatures of life on planets beyond the solar system. I don't know that will happen this year, but that is the cutting edge science right now. And a lot of people have their hands poised over their keyboards ready to, you know, break the alert when they announce a paper. There was a paper earlier this year that said they had biosignatures, but that's now in dispute. A lot of people think it was inorganic processes producing those signatures. But that's going to be, I think, the big news we're looking for maybe this year, hopefully this year, maybe next year, of finding signatures of potential life outside of the solar system.
Yeah, and I've got to ask you, because you brought it up, the solar flare stuff, we've had an incredible amount of solar activity. There has always been a lot of concern about that. So far, everything's kind of held up pretty good. There hadn't been a lot of outages. There's been a few things. But overall, all this stuff we've got up in space, it seems like it's held up a little better than people have thought it might have.
So far, it's held up. We haven't gotten a really bad solar storm yet that's hit us. But I often say with a catastrophic solar flare, like the Carrington event back in the 19th century, which caused telegraph offices to catch fire because it induced currents along the wires. If something like that were to hit, you'd be having a lot of satellite failures, we'd be having power failures and so forth. And we need to get in, being prepared for that, because it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when it's going to happen. We haven't had a really bad flare this solar cycle that's been directed at Earth, but we have had some pretty powerful ones. So far, knock on wood, so good. Hopefully we'll ride out this one. It's a concern right now for the active sun, is a concern for my mission and for Hubble, because it causes an increase in atmospheric drag, which means objects in low Earth orbit have descend from their orbit a little faster. I think Hubble has dropped 12 kilometers in just the last year. So that's something to be concerned about. But right now, it's just been producing spectacular light shows.
That almost sounded like the opening to our favorite space documentary, Armageddon, where he's like, it happened before, it will happen again. Because I know you love that movie so much.
I actually took a fondness to that movie when I did my full review, because
I told you would.
It's scientifically ridiculous, but the thing about that movie is everyone knows what kind of movie they're in, and they play it perfectly. And another example of how Bruce Willis was such a tremendous leading man that he could be in something so ridiculous and make you care.
I still contest, because I love that movie. I know it's scientifically just bonkers, but still, I still contend the thing that makes that whole movie work is Billy Bob Thornton, because he has just the absolute burnt out NASA guy down to a T, where the guy's like, why didn't you find this? And he just looks at him and is like, because you gave me $1 million to search the entire galaxy for this stuff. I can't do it. Like, that is just so pitch perfect. That it feels real, because it is real, even though the rest of it's all ridiculous. Yeah. You're like, oh yeah, that guy's been fighting this for 20 years. I believe it. I really think they got at least those parts of it. They got the overall characters right, I think.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Michael Siegel, we love talking space and science. Beats the heck out of talking about politics, folks. Let folks know where they can find you. I love your YouTube channel. It's a lot of fun, where he breaks down things like sci-fi trailers, movies, things like that. But then when something scientific happens, like the Aurora Borealis a couple weeks ago, he'll break that down as well. Let folks know where they can find you and keep up with you until we get you back on Hertel again, my friend.
Ordinary Times is where I post all my writing and videos. If you want my videos, just go to YouTube and Michael Siegel Astronomy. You'll find me. Right now, I'm almost finished with the episode by episode reaction to Netflix's Three Body Problem series. And then we'll move on to something else. Be sure to check it out. We have a really nice and informed commentariat for YouTube that we're building a little nice community there. So it's good to see.
Dig it. I want to get you on this For All Mankind show at some point, because I think you'll have some interesting thoughts on that, because they're purposely doing it decade by decade, which is some real jumps. And now they're getting way ahead of us, of course. Mm-hmm. But I find it very alternate history. But I think you'd find some interesting stuff there. Dr. Michael Siegel, appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Glad to be back.
All right. Welcome back to Hertel. Now, we've been talking about space in this episode of Hertel. Right after we recorded this with Dr. Michael Siegel, our good friend, the news came out that we lost one of the Apollo astronauts. William Anders was 90 years old. He was flying his beach craft off the coast of Washington State. It crashed. They don't know the circumstances, but he was 90 years old and died. He was on Apollo 8. If you've ever seen Apollo 13, and you remember the famous scene where they're looking at the moon and Tom Hanks is hanging back because he's playing Lovell, and he hangs back and they go, don't you want to look? And he goes, no, I've seen it and I want to go home. Gentlemen, what are your intentions? All that stuff. That's because he's talking about Apollo 8, and William Anders was on Apollo 8 with Lovell and Frank Borman on that first mission to leave Earth and go to the moon. They orbited the moon and came back. They didn't land. But Anders took one of the most iconic photos in all of human history. He took what's called the Earthrise picture. If you don't know what that is, just me saying it, I almost guarantee you have seen it. It's the landscape of the moon and then the Earth rising the way the moon would rise in the evening here on Earth, looking back, and you've got that first glimpse of the globe from, you know, another astral body, in this case, the moon. it's such an evocative image when we talk about this space stuff, because anybody that's gone into space, remember William Shatner went up. It was a little bit of a PR stunt, but it was still pretty cool to have Captain Kirk in space, right? Remember when he got back, he was just overcome with emotions. He was crying. He was almost blubbering. He's just like, seeing the Earth as a ball changes how you think about almost everything. That Earthrise picture that Anders took, and of course, the long life of service, he was an Air Force officer, he was an ambassador, had a remarkable life at 90 years old. But that picture really surmises why we talk about space the way we do. There's policy to things talked about. We kind of teed it up, you know, private versus public, funding, technology increases, you know, humanity striving, all that stuff's great. Something like that photo that Bill Anders took from the moon, that Earthrise photo, is so evocative because it really is humanity doing something beyond itself. You know, was humans meant to go to the moon? Was humans meant to travel interstellarly, which is what we're trying to kind of take our baby steps into, leaving this planet, going beyond even the moon to the Mars. We have Voyager now outside of the solar system. These things are really deep thoughts, but they go to very primitive, primal things inside of us. What's our place in the universe? What does human life mean? What does it mean to be human? And something as simple as a photograph, that Earthrise photograph, just cuts right to that. The immense amount of technology at the time it took to get man far enough away to the surface of the moon to look back at the Earth. Just think about that. But now, from the 60s until the year of our Lord 2024, all the computing power of NASA combined during the Apollo missions, your cell phone that you're probably listening to this broadcast on right now has infinitely more computing power than NASA had during that entire period. Isn't it funny how technology works? We think of the moonshot and how amazing it was and the whole country basically focusing on doing that. And we did it. And what have we done since? Well, that's why we talked to Dr. Michael Siegel today about it. And this is kind of the future of not only space race, but the human race itself. We got more information and technology than we've ever had. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to go somewhere beyond the stars where we can take a picture of Earth that changes people's opinions of all of humanity? Or are we going to keep sending cat pictures and yelling about politics and making fun of each other and losing friends and family on Facebook? It's something to ponder. In the meantime, though, thank you, William Anders, for your many, many years of service, your bravery in the Apollo program, your years of service as a military officer, but very much thank you for catching an image that has inspired so many people and will always stand the test of time, because you knew what you were doing when you took it and you were brave enough to get far enough out there to make that picture possible. Godspeed, sir. And that'll do it for Heard Tell. However you're listening to the program, whether you're watching on YouTube, listening on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio is a great platform if you use that. TuneIn, we're on that platform. If you can name a platform that does audio, we're probably on it. Heard Tell Show, or my name, Andrew Donaldson, we'll bring it right up. Have some exciting writing news on a new thing that I'm going to be doing. Can't talk about that just yet. That'll be coming out in a few days as we record and as this episode releases. So excited to take that. Make sure you are subscribed to herdtell.substack.com. One-stop shopping for everything we do. All the Heard Tell episodes, the back catalog, all our new writing, all that stuff's on there. Make sure you check it out. It's all free. If you want to donate, we will take your money. But it is not going to charge you for the content. You get the content for free. Free subscription gets you everything we do. Plus, it goes right into your inbox. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to go to another platform to find it. It gives you all the links right there. Anytime we do anything, media appearances, whatever. Now, Heard Tell at the Twitter. I'm not going to call it X. If you want to follow along to what we're doing there, my Twitter is 4 for the fire at twitter.com, x.com, whatever they're calling it this week. 4 for the fire. Is my handle. If you want my other stuff besides just, you know, we do the food, the Twitter Supper Club, it's a little bit of joy. So make sure you're following us there. Also, gotta want to interact with us the old-fashioned way on email, herdtellshow@gmail.com. Would love to hear from you. Also, if you go to the Substack, you can comment on everything right there. We see that, we'll react to it. Make sure you share this with other people on your own social media. We don't do any advertising. It's all word of mouth. I've just looked at the stats for the last couple of weeks. The new shows are doing really well. We greatly appreciate you giving us the most precious thing you have, your time. That's why we open the show with that. We always want to acknowledge it, never want to waste it. So whenever you are across the street or around the world, we hope you and yours are well. We hope you're well fed. And we'll talk to you again real soon for more Herd Tell. All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a Creative Content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.